Dr. Pete answered on the third ring, audio only. In the background I heard a chorus of crying children, the constant backdrop of the Magic Kingdom infirmary. "Hi, Doc," I said. "Hello, Julius. What can I do for you?" Under the veneer of professional medical and cast member friendliness, I sensed irritation. Make it all good again. "I'm not really sure. I wanted to see if I could talk it over with you. I'm having some pretty big problems." "I'm on shift until 5. Can it wait until then?" By then I'd have no idea if I'd have the nerve to see him. "I don't think so. I was hoping we could meet right away."
"If it's an emergency, I can have an ambulance sent for you."
"It's urgent, but not an emergency. I need to talk about it in person. Please?" He sighed in an undoctorly, uncast-memberly fashion.
"Julius, I've got important things to do here. Are you sure this can't wait?"
I bit back a sob.
"I'm sure, Doc." "All right, then. When can you be here?"
Lil had made it clear that she didn't want me in the park.
"Can you come meet me? I can't really come to you. I'm at the Contemporary, Tower B, room 2334.
"I don't really make house calls, son."
"No, I know."
Hated how pathetic I sounded. "Can you make an exception? I don't know who else to turn to."
"I'll be there as soon as I can. I have to get someone to cover for me. Let's not make a habit of this, all right?"
I whooshed out my relief. "I promise." He disconnected abruptly, and I found myself dialing Dan.
"Yeah?" he said cautiously.
"Dr. Pete's coming over, Dan. I don't know if he can help me. I don't know if anyone can. I just wanted you to know."
He surprised me then, and made me remember why he was still my friend, even after everything. "Do you want me to come over?"
"That would be very nice," I said quietly. "I'm at the hotel."
"Give me 10 minutes, he said, and rang off.
He found me on my patio, looking out at the castle and the peaks of Space Mountain. To my left spread the sparkling waters of the Seven Seas Lagoon. To my right, the property stretched away for mile after manicured mile. The sun was warm on my skin, faint strains of happy laughter drifted with the wind, and the flowers were in bloom. In Toronto, it would be freezing rain, gray buildings, noisome rapid transit, a monorail hissed by, and hard-faced anonymity. I missed it. Dan pulled up a chair next to mine and sat without a word. We both stared out at the view for a long while.
"It's something else, isn't it?" I said finally. "I suppose so," he said. "I want to say something before the doc comes by, Julius."
"Go ahead."
"Lil and I are through. It should never have happened in the first place, and I'm not proud of myself. If you two were breaking up, that's none of my business, but I had no right to hurry it along."
"All right," I said. I was too drained for emotion.
"I've taken a room here, moved my things."
"How's Lil taking it?"
"Oh, she thinks I'm a total bastard. I suppose she's right."
"I suppose she's partly right," I corrected him. He gave me a gentle slug in the shoulder.
"Thanks."
We waited in companionable silence until the doc arrived. He bustled in, his smile lines drawn up into a sour purse, and waited expectantly. I left Dan on the patio while I took a seat on the bed.
"I'm cracking up or something," I said. "I've been acting erratically, sometimes violently. I don't know what's wrong with me."
I rehearsed the speech, but it still wasn't easy to choke out.
"We both know what's wrong, Julius," the doc said impatiently. "You need to be refreshed from your backup. Get set up with a fresh clone and retire this one. We've had this talk."
"I can't do it," I said, not meeting his eye. "I just can't. Isn't there another way?"
The doc shook his head. "Julius, I've got limited resources to allocate. There's a perfectly good cure for what's ailing you, and if you won't take it, there's not much I can do for you."
"But what about meds?"
"Your problem isn't a chemical imbalance. It's a mental defect. Your brain is broken, son. All that meds will do is mask the symptoms while you get worse. I can't tell you what you want to hear, unfortunately. Now, if you're ready to take the cure, I can retire this clone immediately and get you restored into a new one in 48 hours.
"Isn't there another way? Please, you have to help me. I can't lose all this." I couldn't admit my real reasons for being so attached to this singularly miserable chapter in my life, not even to myself.
The doctor rose to go. "Look, Julius, you haven't got the whuffy to make it worth anyone's time to research a solution to this problem other than the one that we all know about. I can give you mood suppressants, but that's not a permanent solution."
"Why not?"
He boggled. "You just can't take dope for the rest of your life, son. Eventually something will happen to this body. I see from your file that you're stroke-prone, and you're going to get refreshed from your backup. The longer you wait, the more traumatic it'll be. You're robbing from your future self for your selfish present." It wasn't the first time the thought had crossed my mind. Every passing day made it harder to take the cure. To lie down and wake up, friends with Dan. To wake up and be in love with Lil again. To wake up to a mansion, the way I remembered it, a hall of presidents where I could find Lil bent over, with her head in a president's guts of an afternoon. To lie down and wake without disgrace, without knowing that my lover and my best friend would betray me, had betrayed me. I just couldn't do it. Not yet, anyway. Dan was going to kill himself soon, and if I restored myself from my old backup, I'd lose my last year with him. I'd lose his last year. "Let's table that, Doc. I hear what you're saying, but there's complications. I guess I'll take the mood suppressants for now." He gave me a cold look. "I'll give you a script, then. I could have done that without coming out here. Please don't call me anymore." I was shocked by his obvious ire, but I didn't understand it until he was gone and I told Dan what had happened. "Us old-timers were used to thinking of doctors as highly trained professionals. All that pre-bitchin' med school stuff, long internships, anatomy drills. Truth is, the average doc today gets more training in bedside manner than bioscience. Doctor, Pete, is a technician, not an M.D., not the way you and I mean it. Anyone with the kind of knowledge you're looking for is working as a historical researcher, not a doctor. But that's not the illusion. The doc is supposed to be the authority on medical matters, even though he's only got one trick, restore from backup. You're reminding Pete of that, and he's not happy to have it happen." I waited a week before returning to the Magic Kingdom, sunning myself on the white sand beach at the Contemporary, jogging to walk around the world, taking a canoe out to the wild and overgrown Discovery Island, and generally cooling out. Dan came by in the evenings, and it was like old times, running down the pros and cons of Whuffy and bitchinry and life in general, sitting on my porch with a sweating pitcher of lemonade. On the last night, he presented me with a clever little handheld, a museum piece that I recalled fondly from the dawning days of the Bitchin' Society. It had much of the functionality of my derelict systems in a package I could slip in my shirt pocket. It felt like part of a costume, like the turnip watches the Ben Franklin Streetmosphere players wore at the American Adventure. Museum piece or no, it meant that I was once again qualified to participate in the Bitchin' Society, albeit more slowly and less efficiently than I once may have. I took it downstairs the next morning and drove to the Magic Kingdom's cast member lot. At least, that was the plan. When I got down to the Contemporary's parking lot, my runabout was gone. A quick check with the handheld revealed the worst. My Whuffy was low enough that someone had just gotten inside and driven away, realizing that they could make more popular use of it than I could. With a sinking feeling, I trudged up to my room and swiped my key through the lock. It emitted a soft, unsatisfied bzzz and lit up. "Please see the front desk." My room had been reassigned, too. I had the short end of the Whuffy stick. At least there was no mandatory Whuffy check on the monorail platform, but the other people in the car were none too friendly to me, and no one offered me an inch more personal space than was necessary. I had hit bottom. I took the cast member entrance to the Magic Kingdom, clipping my name tag to my Disney Operations polo shirt, ignoring the glares of my fellow cast members in the utilidors. I used the handheld to page Dan. "Hey there," he said brightly. I could tell instantly that I was being humored. "Where are you?" I asked. "Oh, up in the square, by the Liberty Tree." "In front of the Hall of Presidents." I worked the handheld, pinged some Whuffy manually. Deborah was spiked so high it seemed she'd never come down, as were Tim and her whole crew in aggregate. They were drawing from guests by the millions, and from cast members, and from people who'd read the popular accounts of their struggle against the forces of petty jealousy and sabotage, i.e., me. I felt lightheaded. I hurried along to costuming and changed into the heavy green mansion costume, then ran up the stairs to the square. I found Dan sipping a coffee and sitting on a bench under the giant lantern-hung Liberty Tree. He had a second cup waiting for me and patted the bench next to him. I sat with him and sipped, waiting for him to spill whatever bit of rotten news he had for me this morning. I could feel it hovering like storm clouds. He wouldn't talk, though, not until we finished the coffee. Then he stood and strolled over to the mansion. It wasn't Rope Drop yet, and there weren't any guests in the park, which was all for the better, given what was coming next. "Have you taken a look at Deborah's Whuffy lately?" he asked, finally, as we stood by the pet cemetery considering the empty scaffolding. I started to pull out the handheld, but he put a hand on my arm. "Don't bother," he said morosely. "Suffice it to say, Deborah's gang is number one with a bullet. Ever since word got out about what happened to the hall, they've been stacking it deep. They can do just about anything, Jules, and get away with it." My stomach tightened, and I found myself grinding my molars. "So what is it they've done, Dan?" I asked, already knowing the answer. Dan didn't have to respond, because at that moment, Tim emerged from the mansion, wearing a light cotton work smock. He had a thoughtful expression, and when he saw us, he beamed his elfin grin and came over. "Hey, guys," he said. "Hi, Tim," Dan said. I nodded, not trusting myself to speak. "Pretty exciting stuff, huh?" he said.
"I haven't told him yet," Dan said with forced lightness. "Why don't you run it down?"
"Well, it's pretty radical, I have to admit. We've learned some stuff from the hall that we wanted to apply, and at the same time we wanted to capture some of the historical character of the ghost story." I opened my mouth to object, but Dan put a hand on my forearm. "Really?" he asked innocently. "How do you plan on doing that?"
"Well, we're keeping the telepresence robots. That's a honey of an idea, Julius, but we're giving each one an uplink so it can flash bake. We've got some high whuffy horror writers pulling together a series of narratives about the lives of each ghost, how they've met their tragic ends, what they've done since, you know. The way we've storyboarded it, the guests stream through the ride pretty much the way they do now, walking through the pre-show and getting into the ride vehicles, the doom buggies. But here's the big change. We slow it all down. We trade off throughput for intensity, make it more of a premium product. So you're a guest. From the queue to the unload zone, you're being chased by these ghosts, these telepresence robots, and they're really scary. I've got Sunip's concept artists going back to the drawing board, hitting basic research on stuff that'll just scare the guests silly. When a ghost catches you, lays its hands on you, wham, flash bake. You get its whole grisly story in 3 seconds across your frontal lobe. By the time you've left, you've had 10 or more ghost contacts, and the next time you come back, it's all new ghosts with all new stories. The way the hall's drawing them, we're bound to be a hit." He put his hands behind his back and rocked on his heels, clearly proud of himself. When Epcot Center first opened long, long ago, there'd been an ugly decade or so in ride design. Imagineering found a winning formula for Spaceship Earth, the flagship ride in the big golf ball, and, in their drive to establish thematic continuity, they'd turned the formula into a cookie cutter, stamping out half a dozen clones for each of the themed areas in the future showcase. It went like this. First, we were cavemen. Then there was ancient Greece, then Rome burned, cue sulfur odor effects, then there was the Great Depression, and finally we reached the modern age. Who knows what the future holds? We do. We'll all have video phones and be living on the ocean floor. Once was cute, compelling and inspirational even, but 6 times was embarrassing. Like everyone, once Imagineering got themselves a good hammer, everything started to resemble a nail. Even now, the Epcot ad hocs were repeating the sins of their forebears, closing every ride with a scene of bitchin' utopia. And Deborah was repeating the classic mistake, tearing her way through the Magic Kingdom with her blaster set to flash bake.
"Tim," I said, hearing the tremble in my voice, "I thought you said you had no designs on the mansion, that you and Deborah wouldn't be trying to take it away from us. Didn't you say that?"
Tim rocked back as if I'd slapped him, and the blood drained from his face.
"But we're not taking it away," he said. "You invited us to help."
I shook my head, confused.
"We did?"
I said.
"Sure," he said.
"Yes," Dan said. "Kim and some of the other rehab cast went to Deborah yesterday and asked her to do a design review of the current rehab and suggest any changes. She was good enough to agree, and they've come up with some great ideas."
I read between the lines. "The newbies you've invited in have gone over to the other side, and we're going to lose everything because of them." I felt like shit.
"Well, I stand corrected," I said carefully. Tim's grin came back, and he clapped his hands together. "He really loves the mansion," I thought. "He could have been on our side if we had only played it all right."
Dan and I took the utilidors and grabbed a pair of bicycles and sped toward Sandeep's lab, jangling our bells at the rushing cast members.
"They don't have the authority to invite Deborah in," I panted as we pedaled.
"Says who?" Dan said.
It was part of the deal. They know that they were probationary members right from the start. They weren't even allowed into the design meetings.
Looks like they took themselves off probation, he said. Sanip gave us both a chilly look when we entered his lab. He had dark circles under his eyes, and his hands shook with exhaustion. He seemed to be holding himself erect with nothing more than raw anger.
So much for building without interference, he said. We agreed that this project wouldn't change midway through. Now it has, and I've got other commitments I'm going to have to cancel because this is going off schedule.
I made soothing, apologetic gestures with my hands. Sanip, believe me, I'm just as upset about this as you are. We don't like this one bit.
He rumped. We had a deal, Julius, he said hotly. I would do the rehab for you, and you would keep the ad hocs off my back. I've been holding up my end of the bargain, but where the hell have you been? If they replan the rehab now, I'll have to go along with them. I can't just leave the mansion half done. They'll murder me.
The kernel of a plan formed in my mind.
Sanip, we don't like the new rehab plan, and we're going to stop it. You can help. Just stonewall them. Tell them they have to find other Imagineering support if they want to go through with it, that you're booked solid.
Dan gave me one of his long, considering looks, then nodded a minute approval.
Yeah, he drawled. That'll help, all right. Just tell them that they're welcome to make any changes they want to the plan if they can find someone else to execute them.
Sanip looked unhappy.
Fine, so then they go and find someone else to do it, and that person gets all the credit for the work my team's done so far. I just flush my time down the toilet.
It won't come to that, I said quickly. If you can just keep saying no for a couple days, we'll do the rest.
Sanip looked doubtful.
I promise, I said.
Sanip ran his stubby fingers through his already crazed hair.
All right, he said morosely.
Dan slapped him on the back.
Good man, he said.
It should have worked. It almost did. I sat in the back of the Adventureland conference room while Dan exhorted,
Look, you don't have to roll over for Deborah and her people. This is your garden, and you've tended it responsibly for years. She's got no right to move in on you. You've got all the whuffy you need to defend the place if you all work together.
No cast member likes confrontation, and the Liberty Square bunch were tough to rouse to action. Dan had turned down the air conditioning an hour before the meeting and closed up all the windows so that the room was a kiln for hard-firing irritation into rage. I stood meekly in the back as far as possible from Dan. He was working his magic on my behalf, and I was content to let him do his thing. When Lil arrived, she'd sized up the situation with a sour expression. Sit in the front near Dan or in the back near me? She'd chosen the middle, and to concentrate on Dan I had to tear my eyes away from the sweat glistening on her long, pale neck. Dan stalked the aisles like a preacher, eyes blazing.
They're stealing your future. They're stealing your past. They claim they've got your support.
He lowered his tone. I don't think that's true. He grabbed a cast member by her hand and looked into her eyes. Is it true? He said, so low it was almost a whisper.
No, the cast member said.
He dropped her hand and whirled to face another cast member.
Is it true?
He demanded, raising his voice slightly.
No,
the cast member said, his voice unnaturally loud after the whispers. A nervous chuckle rippled through the crowd.
Is it true? He said, striding to the podium, shouting now. No,
the crowd roared.
No, he shouted back. You don't have to roll over and take it. You can fight back, carry on with the plan, send them packing. They're only taken over because you're letting them. Are you going to let them? No!
Bitchin' wars are rare. Long before anyone tries a takeover of anything, they've done the arithmetic and ensured themselves that the ad hoc they're displacing doesn't have a hope of fighting back. For the defenders, it's a simple decision. Step down gracefully and salvage some reputation out of the thing. Fighting back will surely burn away even that meager reward. No one benefits from fighting back, least of all the thing everyone's fighting over. For example, it was the second year of my undergrad, taking a double major in not making trouble for my profs and keeping my mouth shut. It was the early days of bitchin', and most of us were still a little unclear on the concept. Not all of us, though. A group of campus shit-disturbers, grad students in the sociology department, were on the bleeding edge of the revolution, and they knew what they wanted. Control of the department,
ousting of the tyrannical, stodgy profs, a bully pulpit from which to preach the bitchin' gospel to a generation of impressionable undergrads who were too cowed by their workloads to realize what a load of shit they were being fed by the university. At least, that's what the intense, heavyset woman who seized the mic in my Sociology 200 course said that sleepy morning mid-semester at Convocation Hall. 1,900 students filled the hall, a capacity crowd of bleary, coffee-sipping time markers, and they woke up in a hurry when the woman's strident harangue burst over their heads. I saw it happen from the very start. The prof was down there on the stage, a speck with a time mic droning over his slides, and then there was a blur as half a dozen grad students rushed the stage. They were dressed in university poverty chic, wrinkled slacks and tattered sport coats, and five of them formed a human wall in front of the prof, while the sixth, the heavy-set one with the dark hair and the prominent mole on her cheek, unclipped his mic and clipped it to her lapel. "Wakey, wakey!" she called, and the reality of the moment hit home for me. This wasn't on the lesson plan. "Come on, heads up! This is not a drill! The University of Toronto Department of Sociology is under new management. If you'll set your handhelds to receive, we'll be beaming out a new lesson plan momentarily. If you've forgotten your handhelds, you can download the plans later on. I'm going to run it down for you right now anyway. Before I start for you, though, I have a prepared statement for you. You'll probably hear this a couple times more today in your other classes. It's worth repeating. Here goes. We reject the stodgy, tyrannical rule of the profs at this department. We demand bully pulpits from which to preach the bitchin' gospel, effective immediately. The University of Toronto Ad Hoc Sociology Department is in charge. We promise high-relevance curriculum with an emphasis on reputation economics, post-scarcity social dynamics, and the social theory of infinite life extension. No more Durkheim, kids, just deadheading. This will be fun." She taught the course like a pro. You could tell she'd been drilling her lecture for a while. Periodically, the human wall behind her shuddered as the prof made a break for it and was restrained. At precisely 9:50, she dismissed the class, which had hung on her every word. Instead of trudging out and ambling to our next class, the whole 1,900 of us rose, and as one started buzzing to our neighbors, a roar of, "Can you believe it?" that followed us out the door into our next encounter with the ad hoc sociology department. It was cool that day. I had another soap class, Constructing Social Deviance, and we got the same drill there, the same stirring propaganda, the same comical sight of a tenured prof battering himself against a human wall of ad hocs. Reporters pounced on us when we left the class, jabbing at us with mics and peppering us with questions. I gave them a big thumbs up and said, "Bitchin'!" in classic undergrad eloquence. The profs struck back the next morning. I got a heads up from the newscast as I brushed my teeth. The dean of the sociology department told a reporter that the ad hoc's courses would not be credited, that they were a gang of thugs who were totally unqualified to teach. A counterpoint interview from a spokesperson for the ad hocs established that all of the new lecturers had been writing course plans and lecture notes for the profs they replaced for years, and that they'd also written most of their journal articles. The profs spurt university security out to help them regain their lecterns, only to be repelled by ad hoc security guards in homemade uniforms. University security got the message, anyone could be replaced, and stayed away. The profs picketed. They held classes out front attended by grade-conscious brown-nosers who worried that the ad hoc's classes wouldn't count toward their degrees. Fools like me alternated between the outdoor and indoor classes, not learning much of anything. No one did. The profs spent their course times whoring for Wuffy, leading the seminars like encounter groups instead of lectures. The ad hocs spent their time bad-mouthing the profs and tearing apart their coursework. At the end of the semester, everyone got a credit, and the University Senate disbanded the sociology department in favor of distance ed offering from Concordia in Montreal. 40 years later, the fight was settled forever. Once you took backup and restore, the rest of the bitchinry just followed, a value system settling over you. Those who didn't take backup and restore may have objected, but hey, they all died. The Liberty Square ad hocs marched, shoulder to shoulder, through the utilidors and, as a mass, took back the haunted mansion. Dan, Lil, and I were up front, careful not to brush against one another as we walked quickly through the backstage door and started a bucket brigade, passing out the materials that Deborah's people had stashed there along a line that snaked back to the front porch of the Hall of Presidents, where they were unceremoniously dumped. Once the main stash was vacated, we split up and roamed the ride, its service corridors and dioramas, the break room and the secret passages, rounding up every scrap of Deborah's crap and passing it out the door. In the attic scene, I ran into Kim and three of her giggly little friends, their eyes glinting in the dim light. The gaggle of transhuman kids made my guts clench, made me think of Zed and of Lil and of my unmediated brain, and I had a sudden urge to shred them verbally. No. No, that way lay madness and war. This was about taking back what was ours, not punishing the interlopers. Kim, I think you should leave, I said quietly. She snorted and gave me a dire look. Who died and made you boss? She said. Her friends thought it was very brave. They made it clear with double-jointed hip thrusts and glares. Kim, you can leave now or you can leave later. The longer you wait, the worse it will be for you and your whuffy. You blew it, and you're not a part of the mansion anymore. Go home. Go to Deborah. Don't stay here, and don't come back. Ever. Ever. Be cast out of this thing that you love, that you obsess for, that you worked for. Now, I said, quiet, dangerous, barely in control. They sauntered into the graveyard, hissing vitriol at me. Oh, they had lots of new material to post to the anti-me sites, messages that would get them whuffy with people who thought I was the scum of the earth. A popular view those days. I got out of the mansion and looked at the bucket brigade, followed it to the front of the hall. The park had been open for an hour, and a herd of guests watched the proceedings in confusion. The Liberty Square ad hocs passed their loads around in clear embarrassment, knowing that they were violating every principle they cared about. As I watched, gaps appeared in the bucket brigade as cast members slipped away, faces burning scarlet with shame. At the Hall of Presidents, Deborah presided over an orderly relocation of her things, a cheerful cadre of her cast members moving it quickly all off stage. I didn't have to know at my handheld to know what was happening to our Whuffy. By evening, we were back on schedule. Sunip supervised the placement of his telepresence rigs, and Lil went over every system in minute detail, bossing a crew of ad hocs that trailed behind her, double and triple-checking it all. Sunip smiled at me when he caught sight of me, hand scattering dust in the parlor. "Congratulations, sir," he said, and shook my hand. "It was masterfully done." "Thanks, Sunip. I'm not sure how masterful it was, but we got the job done, and that's what counts." "Your partners, they're happier than I've seen them since this whole business started. I know how they feel." "My partners? Oh, yes, Dan and Lil. How happy were they, I wondered. Happy enough to get back together?" My mood fell, even though that a part of me said that Dan would never go back to her, not after all we'd been through together. "I'm glad you're glad. We couldn't have done it without you, and it looks like we'll be open for business in a week." "Oh, I should think so. Are you coming to the party tonight?" "Party? Probably something the Liberty Square ad hocs were putting on. I would almost certainly be persona non grata." "I don't think so," I said carefully. "I'll probably work late here." He chided me for working too hard, but once he saw that I'd no intention of being dragged off to the party, he left off. And that's how I came to be in the mansion at 2 a.m. the next morning, dozing in a backstage break room, when I heard a commotion from the parlor. Festive voices, happy and loud, and I assumed it was Liberty Square ad hocs coming back from the party. I roused myself and entered the parlor. Kim and her friends were there, pushing hand trucks of Deborah's gear. I got ready to shout something horrible at them, and that's when Deborah came in. I moderated the shout to a snap, opened my mouth to speak, stopped. Behind Deborah were Lil's parents, frozen these long years in their canopic jars in Kissimmee.